Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've got 15 minutes or so for questions on each of those presentations. So, please feel free to ask questions. If you could, as before, just say who you are and where you're from. We'll start in the front row, if that's all right, and then we'll go to Christina. But Carol, if you want to stand up and say.
Hi, Carol Burns, University of Brighton. Question for Jeremy. I have to take the opportunity to ask you, I'm afraid, about pre-registration years and whether there are any proposals to make allowances under the Tier 2 scheme for pre-registration students who may not be able to reach the 20,000 earning thresholds but are nevertheless skilled workers and obviously need the year to complete their qualifications.
Sure.
And Christina, if you want to ask your question as well, and then...
Hi, Jeremy. Nice to see you again.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. It's a great privilege. My question is, actually, we discussed that before about sending more UK students overseas for more than 1 year and 1 day. Now, we have some latest developments. You know, there are 2 million small and medium-sized companies in the UK, which the government is very keen to develop. Say, if we try to encourage every single one of them to recruit one UK student and send them overseas to booming economy in China, India, Brazil, Russia, for more than 1 year and 1 day, the whole net migration will be minus 1.8 million, and it means the whole UK education can recruit another 1.8 million international students in the next few 3 years. And say if we pretty much, you know, for every single international student, they pay something around £20,000 a year for their accommodation and international student fee. So it will give the whole UK education £36 billion a year, which means the whole UK education will become the largest exporting industry to help David Cameron and Nick Clegg to realize their economic recovery plan to replace the banking system. So pretty much everyone's happy. So what's your opinion about it?
Well, I've missed this, Christina, I have to say. That's the biggest regret I have of leaving NUS is not being able to engage with Christina on a daily basis. So, Jeremy, those simple solutions for you.
Thanks. Lovely. Over the question Carol asked, I think we are looking quite carefully at people remaining in the United Kingdom to be able to continue their learning before they get their qualification. I think the difficulty with it is where to draw the line. We've already made a series of concessions in relation to doctors, pharmacists, dentists, architects, as I recall. I'd always said to ministers, the list is probably as long as there are students in the country, be careful what you wish for. So I think we have to be careful about where we draw the line, and I think there has to be some care taken by the sector as well as government in where we draw that. But I think we're still thinking and we're still consulting about, because in introducing these processes, there are always courses that we hadn't predicted. I mean, we're a home office, we're not an education department, so obviously we talk a great deal with Biz about these issues, but we need to continue to talk to the sector. So I don't think the door is slammed shut, but we do have to be very careful about how we manage that process. Christina and I have indeed had vibrant discussions on this very topic, and I like you, Aaron, I really miss them when I don't have them. I'd say this, it's a great idea, forcefully argued. It's not one for government, it's one for everybody in this room and for the universities and rest of the sector not represented. Because the idea that you could get a student at a university as excellent as, say, Loughborough or Lancaster or one of the London colleges, it's down to those universities and many other besides to form those relationships with businesses abroad and be able to arrange for students to be able to get a placement abroad. And you're certainly right that it would have an impact on the calculation of numbers. But in a way, more importantly than that, I think it would have a major impact on the depth of skills, the depth of knowledge, and the experience that students will have. And I think those are the things that matter as much as immigration control.
Gretchen, I'm interested. Have you got any sort of perceptions or experiences of why it is that UK outward student migration is sort of as sluggish, as poorly sort of comparable to, you know, other European countries or indeed you know, other countries more generally?
I think the development of an advancement program where the university is actively traveling with the administration, with the admissions office, with the alumni office, with fundraisers that go out and develop relationships and partnerships. And when you're talking to donors, they want to know about, you know, how their dollar can help a student, or if, you know, they want to target money sometimes to scholarships, and then the scholarships lead to, well, what type of scholarships. And, you know, the more outbound your thinking, your practices are as a university that's aspiring to be, you know, internationally minded or global, or just having, you know, more opportunities for students, the more this is going to come up on one's agenda. And so we have an active study abroad program. I mentioned Madrid, but that's a Tufts proprietary program in Madrid with Skidmore. But we have another 12 programs around the world, from Ghana to Chile to Hong Kong to Shanghai to other locations here in London that we've had for many, many years. And we've had a strong, it's been part of our ethic at Tufts to give the students the experience. If they want a year abroad, 2 years abroad, then we help make that possible. International relations happens to also be one of our largest topics, areas of study on campus. So with that in mind, students kind of self-select Tufts because they want to go abroad. They also want that experience of students on the campus. So we make that part of our effort. We do have a very, very good orientation program for international students. So I think it really starts at those early formative experiences.
It's interesting. I've been engaged with a handful of institutions who are actively looking to improve the graduate employability statistics of their graduates, you know, on the Delhi measures, and indeed other more longitudinal measures. And in some of the advice that I've given to those institutions, actually, the transformational impact on graduate destination data of an experience, you know, whether it's a year and a day, or indeed whether it's 6 months or 6 weeks abroad, actually can seriously aid graduates to gain employment in this country, or indeed elsewhere in what we all know to be a very difficult labour market. So it is interesting to see the extent to which institutions are perhaps starting to think about how they can encourage UK students to go abroad.
And it doesn't have to be for a full term or year.
Quite.
We're talking a 3 week, 6 week. It could just be a seminar series that's developed with your alumni, and it could be students virtually kind of going abroad where they meet in an auditorium and you Skype, or you have a conversation with alumni in different areas of the world. They talk about what the major sectors are in that city. And they talk about what it's like to live there and how things are changing, whether it's the BRIC countries or whether it's those upcoming new ones, which acronyms I couldn't pronounce, but Turkey was in there twice. So, but looking at those opportunities and saying, you know, what is the reality of working in these cities? And that tacit knowledge that we talked about, people can't assume that they're going to know, but they're going to really want to hear from the people that are like them that have gone to the school.
Perhaps the delegates will have a better sense of whether there is, in fact, unmet demand in your institutions, i.e., you know, you have the placements out there and you have the relationships, and students actually, they, you know, they want to get in and get out of higher education as quickly as possible, or whether and so there are spaces missing, or whether it's the other way around and actually, you know, you do have lots of students scrambling for places, but actually, for whatever reason, you can only, you know, fix a, you know, 50 or 100 or whatever. I guess the picture's varied, but it'd be interesting to hear from you on that, or indeed other issues. I'll go to James, and then James, then Richard, and then I pointed the wrong way around there. So we'll go to James first, and then Richard, and then I see another hand at the back. I'm not sure.
Thanks, James Kennedy, University of Warwick. It's a question for Gretchen, really. I think we have the impression in the UK that American universities are much better at looking after and indeed loving their alumni than we ever are. Would you be able to give us an idea of, to set up an international alumni chapter in another country, what sort of investment do you put in terms of time from people from your office and the amount of funding you have to provide?
I'll collect a couple of questions if that's all right.
Good. Okay.
Richard.
Hi, Richard Brabner from the University of Hertfordshire. 2 points. There is, when it comes to work placements, there is unmet demand, actually. We have more placements available than students actually taking them up at the moment. And obviously, that's a big issue that we've got at the moment. And obviously, Sir Tim Wilson, who was our previous Vice-Chancellor, is currently conducting this review into business-university collaborations. And I think there is going to be a focus on, particularly on fee waivers and stuff around that with regards to students studying abroad and so on.
Insider knowledge there.
Well, yeah, but I don't know what the outcomes are. I wouldn't be in the place to say, but that is a focus of, that's one of the focuses that we're going to be looking at.
Yeah. Did you have a second point, did you say, or were they the
no,
two?
No,
sorry, yeah. Sorry. And the person at the back. Ah, yes. Stuart.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. Yeah, nice to see you again, Jeremy. I was here last year, and I actually have to say that you're looking much happier and healthier than you were this time last year. So hopefully we're all in a slightly more relaxed environment. I do have a question. Some years ago, we took what was one of the oldest running foundation programs, in the UK, in the University of Essex, and we started, at the pressure from our quality assurance people, started to repackage them into what were embedded four-year degrees. So we put the foundation year added it to the degree program, making a four-year package. We were under huge pressure from our QA people to get rid of our foundation year at that point because it wasn't credit rated and we couldn't apply through UCAS for it and all those sort of things. We didn't give in to that pressure. But this time last year, we thought, wow, these four-year degrees are doing really well. They're recruiting really well through UCAS. The numbers are coming in. And then there was an adjustment of the English language requirements, which meant that we were required to have the same level of English for these programs as going into the degree program, even though the students were studying identical content material. Now, I do take your point you made earlier, which is your government department, not education, there's lots of strange courses out there that you may not have come across in some way or other. But I would put up a plea, this is a little anomaly. If we could please just tweak this little anomaly so that the English requirements are the same for the foundation programs as they are for the embedded four-year courses, that would be fantastic. That would keep the QA people happy as well, because we could bat through UCAS and all of the usual checks and balances are in there. Oh, sorry, Stuart Bannerman, Essex. I'm not sure if I gave my name at the start.
Thanks, Stuart. Gretchen, do you want to pick up the first point about, you know, what it takes, investment and other things to develop the international alumni network?
I realize that we're approaching a break, but I will answer this in 3 minutes or less. James, as a director of the International Center at Warwick, when I first arrived at Tufts a decade ago, I approached the director of the International Center and said, I think we have an opportunity to build out an international network because we have admissions out there on the road. We know that we have study programs, our academic programs out there on the road, and I know that we have alumni out there outside the U.S. So we have the three A's. We have admissions, they're recruiting the students, they're training the students, students are training, and we have alumni that are there to support that effort. And so I think that that's where I started, and I asked, who were the active international students on campus? Who are the leaders that you remember? Who you were in touch with? And so you know those names, and if you've had a history there, or if you're following if you're new to the school, I'm not sure about your history there, but who else has had, who is in touch with the university that's abroad? Likely they're going to want to care. Who's donating from abroad? Have you looked at that, and you're able to kind of look at the list and mine that data with the alumni office? Really, the alumni office is going to need to have several things. They're going to have a committed staff member willing to take up the charge. They're going to have the support from the leaders. The leaders on campus are going to need to support the effort. They're going to need to support it with an adequate fund to start the year. You cannot start something and pull back. Michigan did that. Their president went to China but did not return for 5 years, and the alumni remembered. Now they go every year. And they've been going for years. When I write about in my book, Being Global, Making the Case for International Alumni Relations, truly is about building the readiness and then measuring one's effectiveness and then all the best practices about organizing, managing, training with students, faculty, special events, campaigns, and then kind of the future, you know, the forecast for the next decade. It's about relationships, but you really want to pick pick a couple of places strategically based on where the school thinks it's important to be for all those other reasons, financially as well. We know that. And then hone your efforts on those. Don't try to do everything. And if you have study, if you have a pocket of students in one particular area of the world on a regular basis, start there. Students can be your biggest cheerleader for that effort.
Okay. And Jeremy, do you want to pick up the comment on
the
language?
Being happy. Yes, of course. I'll address the being happy issue. No, always relaxed and happy, Stuart. Don't know what I was doing this time last year. Always happy. You have to be when you're working in the civil service. I'm really interested in the four-year degree issue. I make no promises, but we'll exchange some emails and let's look at what you're doing and let's see if I can talk with policy colleagues around that. And I'll pick up the issue that Carol raised at the beginning in the same way.
Great. No, I'm sure that will be appreciated. And Fabrizio, just before we sort of perhaps wrap up, are you able to sort of give us an update on how, I know it may be not your direct area specifically, so apologies if I put you on the spot, but on how the QAA is progressing in terms of sort of meeting its some of its new responsibilities or new challenges around sort of checking the relevant status of institutions, how far along the way it's going and how it's coping with that.
You mean the new audit method?
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Well, we developed the new this new institutional review method. It's called IRENI. And it is very much based on the it is similar to the older method. It's based on institutional peer review. It has some points of differences, in particular in terms of the way judgments are reached and are formulated. In particular, as it's going to be a new area of judgment that of information. Looking at how institutions provide information. This is it wasn't before. Before there was only two judgments, one on the confidence that could have been placed on an institution's ability to maintain standards, and the other on the confidence that could have been placed on the institution's ability to ensure quality. Now there's going to be also the information bit. But also the judgments are going to be more granular. Before there was only confidence, limited confidence and no confidence. Now it's going to be much more granular, and although it is important to say, this doesn't mean that we're going to start ranking. QA is not in the business of ranking. That's why also we've our mission is not only that of safeguarding standards through institutional peer reviews, but it's very much that of enhancing and supporting the sector. Of course, a crucial area now is that of panning out and developing what's going to mean a risk-based approach to quality assurance. The sector is willing to go towards that direction. It's going to be risky, as any risk-based approach is. But the key issue is will institutions which are taken to be more trustworthy or of a better quality reviewed in a longer time scale, and how long this time scale is going to be? This is a critical issue because, for example, European requirements are, for example, requirement for being part of the European Network for Quality Assurance. Is that institutions are reviewed periodically and surely much less than 10 years. There are a 10-year gap. A 10-year gap would be far too long and probably would put QA outside of the criteria for the European Network for Quality Assurance Agency. So these are the main issues around.
Well, I think it's fair to say, as with that being a sort of a more higher education policy area, as with lots of areas of government policy, sort of the announcement is made and the detail is still to be filled in. I think certainly from the fallout, I think that's a fair word, of the higher education white paper, its fullest detail is still being worked out. Things like a risk-based quality assurance approach, as indeed issues like core and margin, and for another area of government policy, the finest detail of impacts on things like Tier 4. But I have to say, I'm sure I speak on behalf of lots of the delegates here. It is always great to sort of have someone like Jeremy who at least engages and is prepared to listen to the practical reality that you experience on the ground. So can I ask you to thank each of the speakers, please?
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.